going to go first. Mr. Chen?
Thank you, Chief Judge Rader. May it please the court. The PTO greatly appreciates this opportunity to present its views on this very important case. Picking up where Mr. Whalen just left off, I'd say, first of all, we agree on the majority of things that Mr. Whalen is arguing about, which is the intent standard and a balancing need to be clarified and repaired, and we substantially agree with him on those positions. And materiality also needs to be clarified. And in terms of the materiality standard, our view is that to say those three Supreme Court cases called for a but-for standard is incorrect, because 40 years of this court's jurisprudence understood that the kinds of inequitable conduct that could render a patent unenforceable is broader than merely just but-for. And
isn't Mr. Whalen correct, though, in the sense that under at least the current regime of things, applicants in an abundance of caution and out of concern for a subsequent holding of inequitable conduct are, if anything, overloading the patent office with references, many of which may be totally irrelevant and may obscure and not assist the patent office in examining the best priority.
We agree, Judge Lynn, that is the current situation, that we're seeing essentially reference flooding, because right now people don't understand what is the art they need to submit. They are in fear of the inequitable conduct standard, but if this court makes clear what the standard is for materiality and makes clear that the intent standard needs to be a high one, that we're really talking about bad faith conduct, we believe that, and specifically in terms of materiality, adopting or following the criteria set out in our current Rule 56, that's going to give the definiteness and the more peace of mind for applicants to understand what is the art that they should be submitting. In our view, the current Rule 56 sets forth a much more focused, definite, and tailored set of criteria that really give applicants understanding of what is the kind of information we most need.
Go ahead, what about the but-for test that Mr. Whalen was advocating? Would that, in your view, bolster the ability of the Patent Office to proceed as it should, or would that undermine its ability?
In the end, in our view, but-for or the reasonable examiner standard, they're both suboptimal for different reasons. Reasonable examiner, because it's deluging us in pathological overcompliance. But for, the problem with that is permitting a certain scope of gamesmanship and mischief where people are allowed to hide the ball from the examiner on important pieces of information. When you take a particular position on a patentability issue in front of the examiner, that's a pivot point. And when you then learn of information that undermines that patentability position you have taken, then that's the kind of information an examiner needs in order to make a fully informed decision. The basic choice here is, if you go with a but-for, the choice is, do we want these informed decisions based on this information to be done ex ante or ex post?
The but-for standard would allow someone to lie, to affirmatively lie to the patent office about a piece of prior art, and it wouldn't result in inequitable conduct unless you proved that the piece of prior art would have resulted in a rejection. Right?
And that's why we categorically disagree with the but-for test, because the point of those three Supreme Court cases was, when you come to the patent office and you're asking the government to grant you this very important property right that's going to permit you to exclude others from making and using that invention for up to 20 years, you have to act in equity. You cannot engage in some kind of gamesmanship or mischief. And you have to, in this ex parte process, bring forward all those facts that an examiner needs to make an informed decision up front.
But if it doesn't matter to the validity of the patent office still has the option of a disciplinary proceeding. In other words, bad behavior that doesn't matter to the granted the patent can still be dealt with.
Well, first of all, to break apart these two different kinds of patentability categories of information would be inconsistent with what this court's jurisprudence has been. It's always been an understanding that it's broader than just
but we can write on
but for
pretty much
we understand that today. But at the same time, we think it would be inconsistent with the Supreme Court cases. If you look at Keystone, we don't see Keystone as saying there was that particular patent was invalid, and then after it was in, not only was it invalid, but it should be barred from enforcement because of some form of inequitable conduct. It talked about possible prior use, a possible prior use that cast doubt on the validity of the patent, and that prior use needed to get to the examiner in the first instance. That's exactly the kinds of information that 56B2 is looking for. If you have information that's inconsistent with the patentability positions you're taking that undermines that position, we need to get it first. We need to look at it first rather than hiding that, withholding that, and then letting a patent issue and then letting the market get disrupted and then forcing litigators to go through 10 years of litigation only at the end where ex post we finally decide whether that patent would have stood up or not in front of the PTO in the first instance. As a matter of policy, it's not in the public interest to go through all of that ordeal when there's an opportunity to decide that up in the very first instance. That's the whole point of acting in equity in front of the patent office. There's a public interest at stake here. It's not just a private party versus a private party.
Counsel,
did one
guy defraud
another? Counsel,
I think there's some concern that 56B2 will swallow the rule, and if I understand Mr. Whelan's position, it is that if you adopt 56B2, there will be no decrease in the flooding. And you said that, well, if you tweak the intent standard, maybe that might have some effect. But, I mean, isn't 56B2 exactly what the law pretty much is right now? And this is you're in this situation where you're admitting that people are dumping on the office.
Well, right now, the world we're living in is the reasonable examiner standard. And I submit that people don't know really the full scope of the reasonable examiner standard, and they don't know, it's unpredictable in its application. They don't know what a given district court judge is going to understand, what their personal conception of that's going to be. 56B2, however, is much more specific. As I mentioned before, now we're talking about a pivot point where you've taken a stand in front of the examiner on a particular position with respect to patentability. And now, not only that, you know of information that undermines that position, that's either contrary or inconsistent with it.
Well, suppose to understand the scope of Rule 56B2, which I'm having some difficulty with, tell me how you would apply it in the following scenario. You have a representation made by an applicant through an expert declaration or otherwise with respect to a question of underlying science. And there is a tiny sliver of scientific opinion that is contrary to the position you are giving to the examiner, but it's not the position that's widely held. Are you obliged to call to the examiner that sliver of opposing view on the theory that it is inconsistent with the argument that you're making with respect ultimately to patentability?
Assuming all of the factual statement is relating to a patentability question, yes, that would fit within B2, because at this point, in terms of understanding this ex parte process, we're trying to give the PTO the chance to make that fully informed decision. Now, it may be just a minority view, as you pointed out, and that can be expressed in the remarks by the applicant when they're trying to compare off the majority and minority view.
Mr. Chen, there's another, to interrupt this thought, there's another aspect of the public interest, which is the aspect that I think has brought us here today, and that is that we know that inequitable conduct now is being played in a very large number of cases, about a third of those that are filed in the district court. We know that it's sustained in a very small number of those cases. We know that the burden, the litigation burden, is profound, that there are many entities, many small entities, that just cannot afford to go through those doors that are being opened in order to defend themselves. We know all of the additional consequences, the briefs are full of them. And we know that that is what has happened based on the present state of the law. There seems to be no reason why that would be discontinued, whether it's B1 or B2 or a number of the other things. And my question is, isn't this aspect of the public interest, the weight on the patent system, the perhaps discouragement of worthwhile inventions, shouldn't the office also be considering this policy aspect as well as the things that the examiner needs and that should not be withheld?
Of course, Your Honor. We recognize that there is that plague out in the litigation. But in our view...
So how are you resolving it?
So the way we tried to resolve it was going back 20 years ago. In fact, if you look at our Federal Register notice back in 91 and 92, one of the goals of making a clearer standard on materiality was to hopefully minimize the burden of defending yourself against inequitable conduct, because at that time, we were hearing the same kind of complaints that we're hearing today, which is people just feel like the reasonable examiner standard is too unpredictable.
Are you saying a return to Kingstown with its negation of gross negligence?
Absolutely. Yes, driving up the intent standard, because what we're really talking about is bad faith misconduct, and that has to be proven by the single most reasonable inference. And so when you make that clear to the courts, and hopefully Exergen can also help in terms of ratcheting up the pleading requirements for alleging this kind of defense, along with a very clear standard of what is the kinds of information we need in order for you to fulfill your duty of candor, to fulfill your duty to act in equity in front of the government, those pieces together we feel like is going to improve the system. So
thank
it's a
you,
balance.
Mr. Chen.
Okay, thank you.
I think we've got your argument.